this is always a daunting task for me because I am at the podium in a room in which I am sure I know the least about the topic than anybody in the room. You all are experts in STD prevention work. I am not, but this will not prevent me from doing violence to your field. And it hasn't prevented me from doing violence to other fields. But what I am going to do today is to try to do three things. One is to talk to you a little bit about how we think about communications and strategic communications in particular, in theory and a little bit in practice. To then try to lay out for you a short primer on framing, six framing lessons that everyone should know, and then to talk to you a bit about how we've applied this approach to our work on racial discourse in the United States, where we've really been looking at trying to find a different way and a more productive way to talk about race. So I've got 40 minutes or so, and I'll see if I can get this done in that time and leave a little bit of time for some questions. This slide simply makes the point that communications matters. It shapes the culture, it's shaped by the culture. I think it is important to note that it directs the thoughts and actions of policymakers and influentials. I just want to say a quick thing here about that. We're asked all the time, do we think policymakers and influentials think differently about social problems than real people, as if they're not real people? And the answer is generally no, they don't think differently. They have expertise in a narrow bandwidth, but are influenced by the broader dynamics of the culture like most of us. Importantly, communications can aid in the depiction of issues as either public issues, therefore issues upon which we ought to take public action, or matters that are private. And I think in your field, this is a really important distinction. It can prime people for action, and I want to come to this term of accountability and talk just briefly about the concept of attribution of responsibility, which you'll hear me talk about a few times here today. That is, who's responsible for the problem, and therefore, who is responsible for fixing the problem? And I am going to suggest that I think in your field, going through your materials, this is an extremely important distinction to make. The concept of attribution of responsibility, I think, is important. And finally, communications does have the power to propel social movements. And there's a wide literature in sociology about that. So I'm going to do sort of a quick and dirty here and at least try to give you something definitional around the concept of frames. It's the way a story is told. Frames are narratives. And we tell these stories using particular values, symbols, metaphors, messengers, numbers, to trigger a shared and durable understanding. And it's what we use to make sense out of our world. And it's the difference between a frame and spin. In spin, the beliefs are not deeply held, or at least aren't durable over time, because you can get spun over and over again by different kinds of things. And typically, they aren't widely shared in the culture. They may be shared in niches of the culture, and that's why you try to spin left-handed Lithuanians in Fresno to get a 4% higher turnout. But if you are, in fact, interested in systemic and transformative change in communities, you're really in the game of trying to understand the consensual and persistent stories that we tell to make sense out of our world. So frames, another way to think about frames is that they're organizing principles. It's how we organize our thinking about a particular phenomena. And I'm going to use these six lessons for effective framing to try to demonstrate how this works. Lesson number one, communications is fast and frugal. I like to say that people are cognitive misers. Say this again, people are cognitive misers. You know, they're not walking around, oh, if we go outside the hotel here, there aren't people walking up and down the street going, oh, STD prevention, what do I think about that? And if they are, they're probably the person who can't find the hotel and is lost for the conference. But, so in other words, people are taking this information and quickly trying to figure out what it means quickly and getting rid of it. And they are looking for cues in the communication to organize the information that's being presented to them. They're looking for cues in your information, in your communication, to tell them what the communications is about. Frames, when effective, much like good stories, allow us to fill in or infer missing information. In other words, all you have to do is evoke the story with certain cues. You don't even have to tell the story completely, and people will fill in or infer the missing information. I'll give you a quick example, see if I can do this quickly. Some years ago, we did a study trying to figure out if crime news reporting disproportionately showed non-white perpetrators and what effect that had on people's attitudes about race and crime. So we did these experiments where we showed people an ATM murder and put them in experimental conditions, real newscast, the whole deal. At the end of the story, they'd say, police are looking for this man. Some people saw a black guy, some people saw a white guy, some people didn't see anybody, right? And just to be tricky, we morphed the black and the white guys. So he made the white guy black and the black guy white. So these were the exact same guys with the exception of hair, skin color. We did have a little problem with skin color making the white guy black. He was Somali for a long time, and then we kind of moved him down the continent to where it was acceptable because we kept testing it. And so then after we showed them these treatments, we asked them, thinking back, we asked them their attitudes about crime and race, and at the very end of the survey, now this is probably 30 minutes after they've seen this mugshot that at best had been up there for 5 or 7 seconds, thinking back to the ATM murder, can you recall the race of the suspect? Whites accurately recalled seeing the black suspect. Were not very accurate at all when they saw the white suspect. Why were they accurate when they saw the black suspect? Because that's the crime script, that's the frame. Blacks are violent criminals. I'll tell you about blacks quickly in a minute. Now, in the condition where we did not show them anybody, 2/3 of the white respondents said that they in fact saw somebody. Now, you laugh, but that in and of itself isn't bad, because it could be social desirability effects. They don't want to appear stupid. They're just guessing. Maybe I should have seen somebody, so they just guess. So that's fair enough. If they were just guessing, we would expect that the distribution across the race of perpetrator would be 50-50. But it wasn't. 80% of the time, they said the suspect was black. Let me say this again. We didn't show them anybody. 2/3 of the time, they said they saw somebody. In 80% of those cases, they said the person was black. Now, What we found when they did in fact see black and Latino suspects, I should say, is that people had more punitive crime attitudes, wanted the death penalty, three strikes, more prison, and liked and had more negative attitudes towards African Americans and Latinos. The point I'm trying to make here is that people were filling in or inferring the narrative on the strength of the power of the story. Frames are that powerful. We know for a fact that they did not see anybody. We did not show them anybody. So they're going through this cognitive task of filling in the information. On the other hand, frames can be good because they allow you to make inferences beyond the positive. I think one of the things that is hard for people to understand is that the public's not a blank slate. They're just not sitting around as empty vessels waiting for you to drop your nuggets of information about STD prevention in their heads. They are veterans of perception, and they're looking for mental shortcuts to take. Because they are cognitive misers, they're not going to sit and think of all the factors. They're looking for cues to figure out what this information is about. They're looking for cues to tell them which things in their head to pull up to say, ah, this is what the story is about. And the last bullet is important because it says that over time, we develop habits of thought and we create this framework of expectation. So we try to configure the incoming information to what we already know, right or wrong. And I think that's really important. This is a great quote by Roger Schank. Finding some familiar element causes us to activate the story that is labeled by that familiar element. We understand the new story as if it were an exemplar of that old element. Understanding means finding a story you already know and saying, oh yeah, that one. Once you have found the story, we stop processing. Why? Because we're cognitive misers. This is an important point. So in communications, myth and fact does not work, which is a common communication strategy. Bait and switch does not work. Because once the frame is set, people stop cognating about it. So people aren't like this. They're not these pristine bowl waiting for you to drop your little nuggets of beautiful information in there. Rather, your information is going into a swamp in which there's all kinds of nasty stuff out there. Bad things can happen to you in the swamp. You stick your hand in, you don't know what it's about. So I just made a real quick and dirty little swamp for STD. This image is from actual STD prevention material. Some people may recognize it. I try to change the names to protect the innocent. But when you start talking STD and this sort of image of human sexuality comes up, there's a swamp out there, right? Some people are saying, oh, those kids, boy, they need to be more disciplined. In fact, they don't even need to be doing that. They should be abstaining. In fact, they need to go to church or go to the synagogue. There's a whole medical swamp out there, which is about treatment and awareness and information. Is that where your communications get sort of stuck? Obviously, it's around popular culture. So when you start talking about these issues, particularly with younger people, it's about MTV and BET and the stripper culture and movies and TV. And it's about race and gender. And it's about stereotypes and power and culture. All these things are swimming around in that swamp. So your communications isn't this. That's not the context in which it happens. That is not the context in which it is understood. It is understood in the swamp, and the swamp, and you all could probably build a much better swamp than I could, but think about the swamp almost as having a kind of pinball machine type quality, that the communications is banging around in there. That is not a very intentional way to do communications. Lesson two, we reason within the frame. And we assign responsibility to the actors within the frame. In other words, we reason with what we've got. This is, I think, maybe one of the most important things for the work that you all do to understand. My colleague, Shanto Iyengar at Stanford, has written very compellingly about this. He says there's two kinds of frames in a generic sense. There are episodic frames and there are thematic frames. These different kinds of frames set up a different attribution of responsibility. So episodic frames that focus on individuals, on events that are private and psychological, by the way, that's private and psychological, it's an event, it's an episode, right? There's nothing else in that picture. The fix is to fix the individual. The solution is to fix the individual. When the communications is thematic, contextual, environmental, issue-oriented, trend-oriented, ecological, it appeals to people as citizens and demands a solution to be societal. In other words, fix the condition. So if the level of analysis of the communications is at the individual level and the focus is on the individual, people are going to attribute responsibility to resolving the problem to the individual. Fix them, remove them, quarantine them, right? But if the phenomena is understood as existing in a broader context, it raises the level of analysis and demands that the resolution of the problem be aimed at the condition, the environment, the ecology. Let me try to give you an example here. This is just a thought experiment, okay? So remember, we reason within the frame. So all you, don't pay no attention to the blue stuff, all right? Just look at the cows. That's the frame. The frame is the cows. And I'm gonna give you one piece of communication, all right? I'm going to tell you that the cows are sick. And now I want you to attribute responsibility for the problem and the solution to the problem. Well, there aren't a lot of possibilities here, right? Cow's fault? Probably not. The cows just don't wander around and graze, you know, I don't know how it is and where you live, but I grew up in Minnesota and Iowa, and cows didn't do that. Probably the farmer's fault, right? Did something bad to the grass, is giving something, there's something bad in the feed, right? That's all I can reason. So the answer is the farmer has to fix the problem. The cows are sick. All kinds of stuff back there, big factories, smoke. Well, gee, it's somebody else's fault. The company, the government, and the responsibility for fixing the problem now is different. It's not simply the farmer, as long as you consume that the farmland was there before the smokestacks. Lesson number three. Order matters. I think this is an extraordinarily important lesson. Once a frame is established, it will dominate the public conversation and crowd out any other frames. Why? Because people are cognitive misers. Once the story, they land on the story, they stop processing and they don't hear the others. Just as a strategic note, you shouldn't repeat a bad frame. People always say, well, don't we have to acknowledge the other side? No, you do not. Politicians never do it. I'm a political scientist. The early part of my career worked on campaigns for a long time. That was the first rule. You never, ever answer the question. You say what you're going to say. But it's a serious point. It is, why would you repeat a frame that works against your interest? And don't lodge whatever your reframing of the issue is down in the last paragraph. It's the wrong order, right? You set the frame. So let me just give you another thought experiment based on something George Lakoff has taught us. What if I tell you elephants are the biggest animals in the subcontinent. They're really wonderful animals. If you go to the preserves, you can see elephants. Elephants are really, really cool. But now I want to talk to you about the buck-tooth gazelle. What are you thinking about? Elephants. Right? So George Lakoff says, don't think about elephants. We call this an elephant's problem. So I don't know if you can read this first one, but this actually comes from an advocacy communication. Peer influences can be negative, but are more often positive and do not inevitably or necessarily displace parental influences, even among adolescents. Okay? Most people read this as, if my kids have bad friends, bad things happen and they don't listen to me. It tells you, peer influences can be negative. Well, we know that peer influences are negative. And in fact, can displace parental influences. That's why we all monitor who our kids are around. And this is aimed at teenagers, which we already think are doing things they ought not to be doing. Now, I might just be a little sensitive. I have a teenage daughter, so, you know, let's just say Google's a wonderful tool. You're all familiar with the pictures we see on the evening news of teenage super predators, kids bringing guns to school, etc. But what you won't see is the fact that youth crime is actually down nationwide and in our state. Your teenager is much safer in school than driving home from school. Teens are much more likely to be the victims of highway accidents than they are to be victims of school shooting. Okay, the argument here is to try to let you know that your teenagers are safe and you shouldn't worry about school shootings. Well, you've evoked school shootings in my mind. We know that there have been school shootings. And now I'm supposed to believe that you want me to think they're safer of all places as a kid driving around town. Elephants, 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 elephants. Lesson four, ideas and issues come in hierarchies and they track and direct our thinking. And let me just say, higher level frames prime lower level frames. Let me give you an example. We talk about thinking happening at three levels, level one, level two, and level three. And the reasoning goes, people's reasoning goes from top to bottom, meaning they, when you ask them about an issue, STD prevention, they don't go, what do I think about STD prevention? That gets seen through the lens of a bigger set of values. What do I think about individual responsibility? What do I think about opportunity? What do I think about fairness? What do I think about family? Right. A whole range of big ideas, big values that are available to them in which they now reason down through. Now they're looking for, okay, what category of issues are you talking to me about? Oh, this is about health, or this is about teenagers, or this is about kids, or this is about young people. And then they get down to your program. Here's the problem. Most experts take the expert language of level three and travel that to the public conversation. The public has no idea what you're talking about. In other words, they don't have a working expert model of the issue. So as a result, they default to what it is they think they already know. So if I think, if individual responsibility is important to me, and it's important to many Americans, and now I start to reason down, I say, oh, well, you're talking to me about individual responsibility, about the behavior of these people. And if I'm there, I'm not hearing anything systemic, structural, conditional. I'm hearing, well, we need to fix these people. Let me give you a quick example of level one, two, three, and I wish I had time to work through this with you. It's a cartoon. Up the top, it says affirmative actions, where the bus is going. Driver says next stop, Montgomery, 1955, and it's got Rice and Powell in the back of the bus. So the level three is affirmative action. The level two is obviously race. And the level one is progress or lack thereof. So even in a cartoon, you can reason this through. Let me try another one. Unfair racial preference with George Sr. on the left, fair objective standard with Junior on the right. He's holding up a thing that says affirmative action. Junior's saying, got a thing from his dad that says, W, enjoy being a legacy pop. Okay, level three is affirmative action again. The level two is class. And the level one is fairness. Okay. You can deconstruct almost any communication like this. So it depends what I think about these things. And I can come out to different positions on affirmative action. I can support legacy admits, but I can reject traditional affirmative action programs depending on where I start. Why doesn't the public take responsibility for social problems? You got a big social problem in the communities you all work with. Why doesn't the public take responsibility for STD prevention? As you say, there's a big thing on the news this morning, big numbers out there. Why doesn't the public act? Is it because they are venal and small-minded and selfish? Or is it rather a cognitive, not moral failure? They just don't understand what the responsibility ought to be or could be. So one of the ways to get around this problem is to provide them with a mechanism. A mechanism that allows themselves to be empowered as an actor in the scenario. And these mechanisms can usefully use metaphors to bring the issues down to earth for people. It helps their engagement. It helps them to understand how they're supposed to be responsible. It helps them understand how complicated things work, and it inoculates them against spin, and it allows them to reason about other issues. So this is what we call a cognitive mismatch. So this is us, the little person in the middle with our little hammer. We want to be good citizens, but don't know what to do. What's our role? So you start talking to us about climate change. Well, if you give us these images on the left, seas are rising, sky is falling, right? Climate's changing. Well, what am I supposed to do about that? After all, these are essentially acts of God. It's nature. But what's my role? I got my hammer. I'm ready to go. Does anybody know what the thing on the right is? Synapse, all you tricky public health people. I want to go back and talk to education or people, or rural people. Well, there's synapses, right? So if you want to talk about the new neuroscience and early child brain development, right? And now the image is these synapses, and I've got my hammer. What am I supposed to do? It's complicated. It's foreign. I don't know how any of that works. I can't see my role. So what we need is what we call a simplifying model. This is the mechanism. A simple concrete analogy that conveys the essence of an expert understanding. You have to help them cognitively see what their responsibility as citizens can be. So on the left, if you think about this expert understanding, you know, well, what's a typical talk by an expert, right? Well, it's complicated, and there are 15 factors. Factor one, all right, public's done, right? Glazed over, because they know you're going to march through those 15 factors, and they don't have a clue what they're supposed to be. So you have to somehow cohere this for them and give them learning. This is just a slide that says more formally that I'll read one of them. The metaphorical frame that captures both the essence of a scientific concept and has a high capacity for spreading through the population. So spreading virally and maintaining integrity as it goes. So we know these from the science classroom: the heart is a pump, the eye is a camera, all that kind of stuff. But let me just show you an example. So I don't know if you remember back when they were talking about ozone depletion and the hole in the ozone layer. And people had a hard time understanding what that really meant. What does it mean to have ozone depletion? And so we're working with a group, and we came up with this model. Well, it's like having a hole in the roof of your house. And then you started asking people, well, what should you do? Well, gee, you should fix it, and you should talk to your insurance company, and talk to experts, and find out what's going on, but you got to fix it. If you remember when, during the Reagan administration, when this discussion was most vibrant, then President Reagan said, the way to solve ozone depletion was for people to wear hats and apply more sunscreen. Now, I say this because if you understand how this works, you're inoculated against spin. I don't say this in a partisan way, it's just an example, right? If you understand how it works, right, that sounds ridiculous. Ah, my favorite one. You guys can read the read the slide, but I'm going to say it in a different way, in homage to the late Johnny Cochran. If the facts don't fit the frame, people reject the facts, not the frame. Hard for people to understand who are in the fact business. If the facts don't fit the frame, people reject the facts, not the frame. I could give you 100 examples where we've tried this in focus groups to give people quote-unquote real facts, and they argue them away in the most ridiculous of ways. I don't have time to do it now, but take my word for it. So I borrowed this from some materials of yours. These are the facts. Okay, gonorrhea is a sexually transmitted disease. Okay, that's two people. It's sexually active people. It's young people who we know are reckless. And they're so reckless they don't know. Women get involved, they don't know. You can pass it along, nobody knows. And if you don't treat it, you can have a real problem. Well, I'm done after the first two bullets. I know people were happy that the numbers got on the news this morning, but uninterpreted and unframed numbers, uninterpreted numbers are not frames. If people do not understand what the numbers mean, they will default to what they already know or think they know. All right? I mean, we get this a lot. We do a lot of policymakers. Well, I'm in the fact business. I'm just supposed to write briefs. Well, there are ways to write briefs, and there's ways to write briefs. There's ways to use numbers, and there's ways to use numbers. We talk about this as social math. Lots of people do. The one on the left is just a bad example. In the past two decades, energy-efficient standards keep 53 million tons of heat-trapping gases out of the air each year. No clue. I don't know what a heat-trapping gas is. I don't know if 53 tons is big or small. Can you carry it in a canister? Do you need a bunch of trucks? Don't know. Using technology that exists today, we can increase the average MPG of today's auto fleet to 40 miles per gallon, the equivalent of taking 44 million cars off the road. Okay, 44 million cars, a lot of cars. I know that. But it's true. Right? I know that. I have a way to imagine what 44 million cars looks like. That's a lot of cars. I have no way to, I don't know if 53 million tons of heat-trapping gases, I don't even know what a gallon of heat-trapping gas looks like. So I have no way to, I have no metric. And I think this goes on in a lot of the materials, where you put it out there and people have no way of understanding. Is the problem big? So they may think the problem's big when in fact you're saying the problem's small, and they may think the problem's small when in fact you're saying it's big, if it is not framed for them. Another way to say this, if you aren't framing, somebody else is. So how to avoid framing pitfalls? Frames happen quickly. You gotta get it up in the front of your communication. You need to make sure that you're not allowing people to default, particularly if the communication is aimed more broadly to individual responsibility. You've got to set the attribution of responsibility and who's responsible for solving the problems early in the frame. You need to use values that people are familiar with to help them reason about unfamiliar issues. From our point of view, it's about focusing the mind on fixing systems and conditions, not individuals. One of the interesting things when I read through all the materials that I was given is that it reads as if these disease conditions happen in a vacuum. There's sort of passing reference to these communities also have a host of other problems, but there is no discussion of how individual behavior is influenced by contextual matters, by where, in fact, how close health facilities and health clinics in Los Angeles. We're having a huge problem because in the poor parts of town, they're just closing down all the medical facilities. Makes a difference if I have something wrong and I now have to go out of my community 12 miles to get seen, or if it makes a difference, or if I don't have access to care and then I wait until I'm in acute condition and then I show up in the hospital in emergency. It makes a difference if I'm in a house where the housing stock is degraded, there's a wide range of toxins that might interact with any other kinds of conditions I have. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I guess the thing that struck me the most, and I understand that this is not an argument to say you shouldn't tell people to use condoms. It's not an argument to say you shouldn't tell people to get screened. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, when the layperson reads that, they are reading it as all about individual behavior, therefore individual responsibility. A couple of other things. Order matters, rebutting is not reframing. Simplified models help and translate numbers. So I want to add just one more piece of complication. I don't have anybody holding signs up at me telling me how much longer I have, so I'm programmed, I go all day, but I'm just starting to feel warm. Let me try to say a few things about race, because that also rumbles around in what you do. I'm gonna try to do this quickly, and somebody tell me how much time I have left. Just go. Oh, okay, I'm good, I can do this in that amount of time. Okay, so part of what you are up against, and again in your materials, there's a lot of discussion about racial disparities. So when people hear that, they are thinking about race, not health. Race is an extraordinarily powerful cue. Or let me say it a different way, a more benign way. To the extent that they are thinking about race, let me tell you then what comes to mind for people and how it interacts with particularly the overwhelming focus on individual responsibility. Three elements of what we call the dominant frame, the frame that is top of mind for people, what the social psychologists talk about as chronic accessibility. You start to talk to people about race, what comes to mind? And this is primarily talking to majority groups, but also the case with minority groups. We have been doing focus groups, one-on-one interviews, surveys, experiments, all kinds of stuff. So I don't have time to sort of go through the methodologies, but we've written several papers and you can see that. Three elements of the dominant frame that appear almost automatically. The sense that we've made great historical progress and that racism today is now lodged in people, not structures. Two, that racial inequality is best explained by the violation of the value of self-makingness by certain groups in the society. I'm going to explain all these. And three, that whites and non-whites have fundamentally separate fates. They have fundamentally different things that drive their life chances. So, historical progress. First thing people say is, well, look, things have improved dramatically. and they would start mentioning Oprah Winfrey, Bill Cosby, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, as examples of tremendous progress that's been made in the last half century or so. And at some level, that cannot be disputed. Right? There have been changes. There's absolutely no doubt about that. 60 years ago, I don't know, some of you from Chicago here, let's see, 60 years ago or so, many of us wouldn't have been allowed in this hotel if it was here. I certainly wouldn't be up here. So you've got to acknowledge that there have been changes. But here's the problem. They don't see the other half of the story, which is that, well, they do. Let me go on. Let me say one thing about these frames. They have an internal logic to them. Rightly or wrongly, they have an internal logic to them. So let me play out this logic, and then I can come back to that. So the one strand of this historical progress notion is that things have dramatically improved. They've dramatically improved because they're the direct result of anti-discrimination policies at the state, local, and federal levels. The government has legislated discrimination away. And little more can be done because there are just some bad people out there. And you'll never be able to legislate their racism away. And it will remain constant because these bad people pass it on to their bad little children. I'm serious, that's what people say, right? The children growing up in these racist homes are socialized to be racist. Some reject it, but at least enough don't that a common state of racism will exist no matter what you do. Ah, but there's an interesting twist. If racism is personal, that it's just in the hearts and minds of bad people, then bad people can come in all colors. So people quickly started talking about reverse racism. All of this keeps the conversation out of talking about any kind of bias in institutions and structures. Second part of the dominant frame. What's interesting is that people are still willing to acknowledge that there's racial inequality in the society. Across any number, they don't dispute that. And I was a little surprised because I thought people would dispute it. They don't dispute it. But they explain it as the failure of minority groups in general, blacks in particular, to live up to the core values of self-makingness. Now, let's think about this one pretty seriously. If what they're saying is any disparity is a result not of discrimination, why? Because we've legislated discrimination away. So it can't be that. It therefore must be the failure of some groups to properly assimilate core American values like individual responsibility, like being a self-making person. In your field, where much of the discussion is around individual level behavior, and now you tie race to it, you end up right here, in my humble view. So it's individual responsibility, not discrimination, to driving value. And all of this leads people then to conclude that whites and non-whites have separate fates, that their life chances are determined by fundamentally different dynamics. For whites, they control their own fate. They are masters of their volition. For minorities, blacks in particular, their fate is determined by circumstance and chance. Let me give you one quick example. Some of the coverage of Hurricane Katrina. Let me give it to you through this separate fate lens. So people knew the hurricane was coming. How do we know that? Well, we know it because the news reported, but we also know it because there's at least some evidence that it was the largest peacetime evacuation in American history. People got out. Well, which people got out? Well, what did you need to get out? You needed a car, you needed a credit card, you needed money in the bank, you needed a place to go, you needed all kinds of things and networks that were not equally distributed in the city of New Orleans. So if you knew the hurricane was coming and you controlled your own fate, you got your family and you got out. So then who was left? I mean, we know what the real story is, right? To be poor was the worst thing, regardless of color. To be poor and black was probably second worst. And to be poor and old was second worst. And to be poor, old, and black was the very worst, right? But when you see the Superdome, these are people not controlling their fate. And they are left to just survive. They are victims of their circumstance. And in fact, there are well-published news reports which show that captions of news reports with whites walking with goods above their head in the water, in chest-high water, with the captions that read, "A resourceful New Orleans native trying to provide for his family." Blacks walking with stuff above their head as looters. There's a couple papers on this. This is pretty cool. All I'm trying to do is to use this as an example of how minorities get understood as the other, as understood as living in a parallel universe, and therefore as being not worthy of intervention. Or if there is intervention, it needs to be over there by those people. In other words, there's no sense of interdependence. There's no sense of shared fate. There's no sense of broader community, all the things, there's no sense of vulnerability. Let me try to show you how this, see if I can get this to work. So it conceals system structures, conditions, it conceals a role for collective action, it totally conceals any agency and empowerment of minority communities, and it's again defaulting to the individual, it's defaulting to individual responsibility. So we tried to reframe this, and I'm running out of time, so I want to tell you about a few, and I do have some hopeful signs I think I can get to at the end very quickly. So we said, well, let's see if we can reframe this. Let's try three different sort of models of reframing, and really almost simplifying models. The first was this idea of the miner's canary from the Lonnie Guinier and Gerald Torres book. To try to argue, it's a prevention frame. It says, you all know the story of the miner's canary in the mine? Yeah, no? Yeah, most people know, right? You take the canary down there. When the canary gets sick, you know it's time to get out of the mine because it's too toxic. So we asked people, gave them the story, and said, well, what do you think the story is about? They had two very disturbing answers. The first was that, well, there must have been something wrong with the canary in the first place when it went down there. Now, you gotta get your thinking to now, they're really being asked to talk about vulnerable communities. You with me here? So this defective community. The second one was, boy, that canary's really sick. You should quarantine it. This is important because we were talking about vulnerable communities, right? Just using this as an analogy. So either deficient culture or put them over there and keep them away from us. This one fell to what we call the graveyard of framing hypotheses. We got real encouraged by the affirmative action case in Michigan, where briefs were filed by the military and by corporate interests who said, look, diversity is strength. It's a global world out there. We have diverse workforces, diverse militaries. We need to encourage diversity in our organizations because in and of itself, it strengthens them. Pretty powerful argument. We found that that didn't work either. People saw diversity as something, as an obstacle that you had to overcome. If you got diverse people in a room, that they would spend all their time trying to figure out what to call each other. And actually, I was doing a presentation for the Kellogg Foundation yesterday in Memphis, and that exactly happened. Blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans spent half the time trying to figure out what they should call, because somebody would call somebody Indian, and they would say, I'm not Indian, I'm Native American. The person would say, no, that's not right, we're indigenous people, and they spent a lot of time doing that. So it was obstacles. Diversity is obstacle. The last one, we were told by social justice advocates that, look, what you have to do is to explain white privilege to people. That people need to understand the built-in advantages in the society and how the playing field is not level by historical reasons. So we tried to use several different ways to explain white privilege. And the result of that was what our cognitive linguists called, people had cognitive blindness. They could not see it. It wasn't even a question of wanting or not wanting to. They just could not see it. And I kept thinking, what's the analogy here? How do you just not see it? And I started thinking back to when I was a kid, and my dad had a 67 Chevy. And if you remember, they had those big panels in the back, and nowadays our cars have windows all around. But these big panels, and you literally almost had to lean out the other window to see back there. You just couldn't see it. Remember what we used to call, what do we used to call that? The blind spot. No matter what you did, you couldn't see it. And I started realizing that's what they mean by cognitive blindness. They just can't see it. And the most enlightened folks just get a glimpse of the 18-wheeler as it hits the car. So I'm going to end with a little hopefulness. What we have found, and I'm probably just going to get a chance to talk about the first one, is we did start to see some movement around the concept of opportunity. So the value of opportunity, to talk about the value, the opportunity structure in the society, and to see if we could find ways to talk about where it was broken. Because what we learned is that if you try to talk explicitly about discrimination in the society, people shut down. Because it was, again, the attribution of responsibility fell to individual institutional racism that people weren't prepared to accept given the dominant frame. So we developed something we called the prosperity grid as a way to talk about opportunity. Economists now agree that one of the most practical investments in American life would be to plug minority communities into the network of institutions that make prosperity possible. Banks, home and business ownership programs, educational institutions, you could put in here medical facilities, blah, blah, blah. Experts call this the prosperity grid. The white population has been better connected over the years to these institutions. Minority communities have never had the opportunity to get connected to the prosperity grid in the same way. Plugging minorities in would build their prosperity, create a stronger economy overall, and improve American communities. So what this notion tries to get across is that there's sort of a grid of success out there, that there are networks and of opportunity out there. And in some communities, that grid is broken. It's just broken down. And you don't have to get into an argument about why, and in fact, I would say we know why, but that's not the argument you want to have. And one of the reasons we put American ingenuity in there as well, and we found some traction for it, is that Americans believe that they can solve problems. Right? And we do. All these people in this room, many of you are in communities where you're working and you actually are solving some problems. You actually are getting some traction. It's not like nothing ever works. The problem is we never talk about those. And so we started talking to people about opportunity for all. What this is not meant to be walk out the door, wordsmithing, campaign language. It's meant to convey a concept that this allows you to get interdependence into it, so it gets you over shared fate. It talks about the structures, so it gets you out of individual responsibility. And it doesn't get into the blame game about who's responsible for the racial inequality in the first place. it's a fair discussion to have, but it's a tough one for the communications. So I'm going to end with this. Intractable is not inevitable. There are ways to talk about race that can open up the public dialogue. We used the Prosperity Grid and Opportunity in Spartanburg, South Carolina, to a group of blacks and whites who'd never ever sat in the same room, leaders, and had a very productive conversation. They've now formed a study circle. They're mapping the prosperity grid in their community to show where it breaks down for all people, right? Let me, this point I want to make, I really, really want to make it strongly. Don't confuse the social analysis with the communications analysis. What the expert analysis is of the problem may be different from the communications analysis to how to get civic engagement to solve the problem. I think experts have they walk out of here and they say, he says I can't talk about STD prevention because it's going to default to the individual. That's not what I'm saying. Or he doesn't believe that, or he, we, they. That analysis is accurate and has all the expert learning that you all have. But that may be different than the way you have to talk about it to engage the general public. So you all start talking at level 3, which is where the social analysis is, and the public's going to default to individual responsibility at level 1. So you have to find out. It may not be opportunity, by the way. These are discoverable propositions. You could find out what sets up STD prevention better as a value statement. And so I'm not arguing that it's opportunity, but you could find out. And whatever you do, you want to keep the primary goal in mind, at least from my point of view. And that is, I hope what we all are trying to do is transform vulnerable communities and to be agents of change in these communities. The goal is to make our community stronger and better. So I hope what I've told you today helps. Thank you.